That's it for Living in the USA for today. Our producer and social media maven is Renee Reynolds. Our audio editor is Alan Minsky. Thanks, as always, to Rye Cooter for our theme music, Mambo Sinuendo. If you missed part of this show or any of our recent shows, you can listen online anytime you want at applepodcast.com, Living in the USA. I'm John Wiener. We'll be back next week talking about politics, thinking about the left, and living in the USA.
Donating your car or boats is an excellent way to help KPFK stay alive and on the air. All you have to do is call 877-KPFK-AUTO. That's 877-KPFK-AUTO. And we will take care of everything. Seriously, it's that simple.
You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. We live in a global world. We are all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities, are responding. We also discuss the relationship between art and politics. Now to news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Christina Onnested. President Donald Trump says he's canceled the second wave of attacks on Venezuela and wrote on social media, the U.S. and Venezuela are working well together to rebuild the country's oil and gas infrastructure, and quote, at least $100 billion will be invested by big oil, all of whom I will be meeting with today at the White House, unquote. Trump's pledge to take some 50 million barrels of oil from Venezuela, which has the world's largest oil reserves, after his attack and capture of the country's leader over the weekend. The U.S. military said it seized another oil tanker in the Caribbean headed to Venezuela. The Olina is the fifth tanker seized by U.S. forces as part of Trump's move to control the distribution of Venezuelan oil and uphold U.S. sanctions on Russia and Iran. This comes as the U.S. Senate passed a war powers resolution with bipartisan support Thursday to limit President Trump's military escalation in the Caribbean, Lauren Schmidt reports.
Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer said the vote sends a clear message of opposition to what he called the administration's adventurism into Venezuela and beyond.
And we must send Donald Trump a clear message on behalf of the American people, no more endless wars.
The Senate voted 52-47 to advance the measure, guaranteeing a final vote next week. While the resolution faces long odds, the vote marked a significant show of unease among several Republicans, including Rand Paul of Kentucky, Josh Hawley of Missouri, Susan Collins of Maine, Todd Young of Indiana, and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, who voted in favor. President Trump responded on social media, saying those senators, quote, should never be elected to office again, close quote. The resolution is unlikely to become law. Even if it passes the Republican-controlled House, it would require President Trump's signature. I'm Lauren Schmidt.
Allie Rosenbluth with the group Oil Change International criticized Trump's meeting with oil executives, saying, quote, today's meeting is meant to ensure the future of Venezuela is being shaped in a way that maximizes big oil profits and Trump's power. Meanwhile, the Venezuelan people, U.S. taxpayers, and the climate are being set up to pay the price, unquote. Another shooting by a federal immigration agent, this time in Portland. Two people were wounded, leading Portland's mayor to urge ICE to suspend its operations in the city. The shooting comes just 2 days after a federal immigration agent shot and killed a woman in Minneapolis, Minnesota. In Portland, the two victims were transported to a hospital, their conditions unknown. Meanwhile, the Minnesota Star Tribune has identified the shooting agent in Minneapolis as Jonathan Ross, who during another ICE action was reportedly dragged from a vehicle last year in the state. The Trump administration continues to defend Ross's fatal shooting of 37-year-old Renee Nicole Good. Civil rights advocates rallied in Minnesota yesterday urging accountability. But Minnesota Governor Tim Walz says that may not happen, noting the Trump administration banned Minnesota investigators from assisting in its investigation and its withholding video evidence.
It feels very, very difficult that we will get a fair outcome. And I say that only because people in positions of power have already passed judgment, from the president to the vice president to Kristi Noem, have stood and told you things that are verifiably false.
The authors of a bill requiring the release of the government documents on wealthy pedophile Jeffrey Epstein are now calling on a special master to oversee the release. Silicon Valley progressive Democrat Ro Khanna and Kentucky Republican Thomas Massie sent a letter to the federal judge overseeing the case of Epstein's former partner Ghislaine Maxwell, who was sentenced for trafficking minors, urging the judge to appoint a special master to force the Department of Justice to release all the Epstein files. They note the DOJ has released 12,000 of the more than 2 million documents subject to the act, and later wrote there could be upwards of 5 million documents. A Newsweek report this week, citing filings from the Department of Justice, wrote at the slow pace of release, Trump's DOJ won't complete the release until after he leaves office. Trump is cited in the Epstein files. The House passed an extension of Affordable Care Act subsidies to help some 22 million Americans afford health care coverage Thursday. It heads to the Senate next. I'm Christina Onnestad reporting for Pacifica Radio.
Those were the news headlines from Pacifica Radio. You are listening to Sojourner Truth Radio with your host, Nana Jumpy. Today on Sojourner Truth, we talk with Beth Van Sock on the U.S. attack on Venezuela and the seizure of its first family, followed by a commemoration of the one-year anniversary of the Altadena fires and the spirit of resilience and renewal with Stacey Yildel. All this and more on Sojourner Truth Radio, after this short music break.
Everybody run, run, run. Everybody scatter, scatter. Some people lost some bread. Someone nearly died. Someone just died. Police, they come, army, they come. Hey, confusion everywhere. Hey, 7 minutes later. All don't
you are
go
listening
down
to
down
Sojourner down Truth Radio with your host, Nana Jumpy. That is Sorrow, Tears, and Blood by the great Fela Kuti. On January 3rd, the United States launched military strikes on Venezuela and seized President Maduro, his wife, Celia Flores, and their son. There has been global condemnation of these attacks and the seizure of President Maduro and his family from across the world, and protests as well throughout the United States, Venezuela, and other countries. I'm so glad to be joined by Beth Van Sock to discuss the U.S. attack on Venezuela and its impact on international rule of law, U.S. diplomacy, and the rights of the Venezuelan people and sovereignty of people everywhere. Small task here. Beth Van Sock is a former ambassador at large for global criminal justice in the Biden-Harris administration, in addition to being a co-founder of the Alliance for Diplomacy and Justice. She is also a distinguished fellow at Stanford's Center for Human Rights and International Justice. Welcome, Beth. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
So before we get too far into this, please share with us a little bit about the Alliance for Diplomacy and Justice.
Thank you. Yeah, we formed right after the inauguration. We were all holding human rights mandates within the Biden-Harris administration. These are very senior female diplomats who had responsibility for dealing with racial justice and equity, countering human trafficking, Afghan women and girls, international labor rights. I held the global justice portfolio. And we were distraught about what we saw as the future of American diplomacy around these issues. And so we formed the alliance in order to try and save some of this work, to center international human rights within U.S. foreign policy, and frankly, to imagine how this could be done better, understanding that it has been deficient in previous administrations. And so we have both a sort of current rapid response role, but then also really thinking to the future.
And this wasn't on my, you know, my bingo card or what I was supposed to be talking about today with you, but it seems that the United States is pulling out of everything. Pulling out of the permanent form of people of African descent, pulling out of, you know, these dozens of entities that are focused on all of the issues that you raise, with its usual conversation about extremist thoughts and extremist behavior and radical thoughts. Talk to us about what the real life impact is of that. You know, even if, as some people are thinking, well, it's just for 3 years, which, you know, we don't know about that. But what is the real life impact of that withdrawal of the United States from these really important international spaces?
Indeed, President Trump recently issued an executive order doing exactly as you described, withdrawing the United States from a number of international organizations, treaty regimes, mechanisms for coordination. And I think the damage is both on the multilateral level in terms of weakening these institutions without having U.S. diplomatic support or expertise or funding, but it also ultimately weakens the United States' authority and influence on the international scene, because we're pulling out of the very fora in which states come together to try and address global problems that can only be successfully tackled when we coordinate and when we work together. And so we're essentially not only relinquishing our own leadership in those spaces, but leaving a giant vacuum for China, for Russia, for other scofflaws to enter and be influential within those fora. So it's disastrous for people of African descent, for women and girls around the world, for climate issues. The counterterrorism organization we pulled out of, so we won't be as effective in terms of countering terrorism around the world. These were organizations that have been formed around key global issues, and we should be a part of those looking for solutions. And instead, we're withdrawing and attacking them.
I'm thinking about the fact that, you know, so many of these entities are headquartered or put in buildings that are headquartered in the United States. So when I think about the permanent form of people of African descent, granted, this year we're going to be in Geneva, but normally the following year we would be in the United States. I don't even know if people are going to get passports to come in here. But obviously, if the U.S. is pulled out of PIFPAD and of all these other entities, what does that mean for the United Nations being in the United States and all of these meetings and convenings, including the General Assembly, happening here?
Well, I would not be surprised to see more and more meetings moving to other capitals around the world. We have made it so hostile here and so difficult to come. There was recently a meeting of the Assembly of States Parties, of the International Criminal Court, et cetera. Many people just never got visas to be able to attend some of these meetings. And so at some level, as it becomes harder and harder, that work is just going to move outside of the United States. And we're going to see these convenings happening in other states that are much more hospitable to people traveling and then to the issues involved.
And it's clear that a lot of these moves by the United States at this time with this particular regime
is because they don't want to be held accountable by the world. They don't want the world to be able to lift up their hand and to talk about what the United States is doing, including folks from inside the United States, right, who are speaking up about violations that are happening to them. And so thinking about these latest attacks on Venezuela, generally, they've been globally condemned, even where governments and or international institutions have expressed opposition to President Maduro's leadership itself. Those same countries and institutions have still condemned the military attacks on Venezuela and the seizure of the Venezuelan First Family. And so what does that, you know, why is that happening, firstly? Where, you know, where is that coming from? What basis do people have for this? Because as we'll talk about in a bit, you know, the administration is saying, hey, no harm, no foul. We're allowed to do this. I don't know why everyone's squawking.
Well, first, your initial observation is exactly right. The United States has often found it quite difficult to subject itself to international scrutiny, and we avoid institutions that are likely to criticize actions that we've taken on the world stage. And many of us who've been diplomats have fought against that and have tried to join these institutions, in part because we think that's part of a mature role that a state takes in the international community. We should be willing to defend the actions that we take on the international stage. And if we have legal arguments that we think basically defend those actions, then we should articulate those and be ready to have a dialogue about it. In this case, we're seeing a withdrawal from all of this. And as you say, the most recent events, in particular, the invasion of Venezuela and the kidnapping and seizure of the leader of the country, whether, you know, de facto or not, has drawn a lot of criticism, even as you note, everyone notes that Maduro was a brutal dictator. There are still hundreds of individuals who are political prisoners being held in horrific conditions. And we have not done anything to try and alleviate those situations. Instead, we're completely focused at this point on trying to control the oil reserves within that country. And so indeed, there's, you know, no legal argument that can be made under either domestic or international law that seizure of the de facto head of state of Venezuela was lawful. And as you note, a number of legal arguments are being advanced as to why that's unlawful. Now, what the problem is, there's really very few fora in which individuals who would have complaints about that course of conduct can raise them, because we don't subject ourselves to the world court, the International Court of Justice, or our own courts, which likely would consider this to be a political question. And so they wouldn't touch the issue from a legal perspective. That said, I think it's really important to work through the legal issues and to be on record as to noting that this is an enormous, severe breach of the UN Charter, which we were central to establishing. All of these institutions, we were a part of establishing, and now we're forsaking them. And it's weakening the entire multilateral system that, frankly, really benefits the United States and has benefited it for decades.
How do we respond to, and I'm saying we because I'm certainly not a diplomat. I've never been an ambassador, but I am a person who acts as a delegate to go into these global spaces. And I hear often from my comrades and my colleagues, you know, these spaces are useless, that we have these laws that are international laws, and then the United States or some such country violates those laws, you know, Israel, whoever it is, violates those laws, and people maybe, you know, write statements and get upset, but there's not anything really that occurs. What does that, you know, what does that say about the system that we have now? And what are maybe two or three things that we could be doing that could make it be a space where people are held accountable? Because they're not, I mean, to the degree that you can hold people accountable, self-accountability is certainly not happening. And so at least consequences, how can consequences be happening, and how could we be doing this differently so that countries could really hold other countries to account by virtue of consequences?
Well, I'm a huge believer in not allowing breaches of the law to ultimately weaken the law. We have to insist upon the legal standards. We have to document when those abuses occur and to do so rigorously under the law. We need to preserve all of this for future accountability if there are ever openings to do so. And we have to look for, as you asked about, opportunities to have our voices be heard. And it's interesting to see in your earlier reporting, before we started our conversation, just talked about this, Congress seems to have woken up a bit on this, and we're starting to see Congress move, including in a bipartisan way, because the breaches of domestic and international law are so obvious here, and also weakening the congressional authority to wage, ultimately to declare war and to fund the U.S. diplomats and the U.S. military. And so using our voice and our vote as ordinary citizens is incredibly important. Our members of Congress need to hear from us that we think this line of conduct is unconscionable and that there should be consequences and that Congress should do what it can to have hearings, to have a better understanding of the administration's position, to assert its power of the purse if it can, to assert its oversight role, to assert its documentation role, whatever it can do in order to try and reassert the rule of law within this country. And that's what we can do. We can also take to the street. We can write op-eds, all of the things that many of us are doing. We have to keep doing those. We can't let despair reign because, as the great Audre Lorde used to say, despair is the tool of our enemies.
Despair is the tool of our enemies. Yes, resistance, let resistance be our motto, said the great Henry Garnett. Gotta let resistance be our motto in every space. How do we get some, you know, how do we get some countries in this? What's happening right now on the global stage? We know, of course, we've seen statements by the AU, by CARICOM, by individual countries. I think I saw something by the Organization of American States. Like, we have seen some things come out. The Secretary General put something out, a lot of different entities. But what is happening move-wise, like in terms of meetings, in terms of conversations or anything that people might be bringing forward to the UN, if you know what those things may be?
Yeah, it's all happening so quickly. So it's hard to know what's actually happening in the immediate moment. And honestly, the cadence of meetings of the United Nations and of some of these special bodies can be slow at times. And so, you know, when these issues will come on the agenda will differ depending on the particular organization. We are, though, as you note, seeing a groundswell of opposition and criticism to some of the decisions that are being made. Before actually boots were on the ground and it was mostly talk and rhetoric and bluster, it was one thing. But now we have an actual operation that has involved, you know, to begin with, killing individuals on the high seas on, you know, what may be quite flimsy factual bases with no legal justification necessarily, and now has moved into a full-scale invasion of another sovereign country, one that admittedly was being run by a dictator, but that doesn't give us the right to go in there and remove that individual. And so, you know, what the international community is saying and doing is, I think, happening in very diplomatic circles, and I'm no longer in those circles, so it's hard to know. But I think as President Trump starts speaking about where he might go next, that has to organize individuals and those regional groups that you talked about to recognize that he may not stop with Venezuela. He may be moving elsewhere. So, you know, Greenland and Denmark and other states are quite concerned. And I think we have to put NATO top of mind here, because if the United States were to attack or engage in other forms of coercion to try and get control and quote unquote ownership, as he seems to insist on, of Greenland, that will lead to the destruction of NATO. That is one NATO member attacking another NATO member. It would be unheard of. So my hope is that the Europeans in particular will start to rally more strongly, and then likewise in these other regional configurations. And, you know, we had already a meeting of the Security Council, in which the United States activities in early January were roundly condemned by other members of the international community. But as I said, there are no forum in which other institutions can exercise any kind of executive authority over the United States. There aren't courts necessarily that can hear these claims. I know that there are lawyers that are out there looking for claims that might be able to be brought before the International Court of Justice in The Hague or elsewhere. The International Criminal Court has jurisdiction over events on Venezuelan territory. So any international crimes that might have been committed during the kidnapping and seizure of President Maduro, so-called President Maduro. I want to acknowledge that he stole the election in 2024, so he's not the legitimate head of state, but he has been acting in that capacity as head of state. And so the International Criminal Court may be able to exercise some measure of jurisdiction here. The reality, though, we all have to admit, is that states are scared. States are scared about the tariff power. They're scared about other ways that the United States may move against them if they try and oppose any of the moves that are currently being taken. And so it's a very difficult environment in which for states to organize any kind of a multilateral response.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting because I look at the statements, the allegations, the accusations, the comments, et cetera, that are made around not just President Maduro, but other people that are sort of put in that category. And, you know, as long as we got President Trumpuro over here illegally grabbing people up, including U.S. citizens, putting them in detention prisons, getting freedom of the press to darn near come to a standstill, you know, amongst the list of many other things, voter suppression, et cetera, et cetera. I think that even in the U.S., people should be worried. I mean, the reality is I know that folks have a notion that the United States has this military and that no one would decide to look at the U.S. and say, hey, maybe we need to deal with the dictator they got over there. But that's all possible. I think that people should be concerned about everyone's sovereignty being on the table, because at the end of the day, sovereignty is really bottom line the issue, no?
Well, it will be very interesting to see where the sort of MAGA base goes with this move, because they elected this president on an America First agenda. And he promised to not get into this sort of adventurism that he blamed on previous administrations. And yet in his, you know, first year, we've commenced an international armed conflict with another sovereign state. And that conflict is still ongoing because there are still threats being issued. There are still embargoes, et cetera. So, you know, this is really runs counter to some of his promises and some of their expectations. And so will they start to peel away that support, or will he be able to convince them of his theory of the case here, that this was about national security and that it was essential that we go in and that we remove Maduro and that we seize the oil and turn it to our own benefit? Likewise, there may be claims by foreign companies that have claims to that oil as well, that may be able to bring claims against U.S. companies if they take possession of those oil reserves. So, you know, we're going to see a lot of different ways in which different private and public entities may try and oppose what's happening here. But, you know, as you know, we have to be organized. We have to keep up with the news cycle because it's so relentless, and not lose sight of some of the legal issues involved.
Yes, absolutely. I'm thinking of Greenland. I think that would be a very interesting move because people absolutely don't expect a move by the United States against a European country. But I'm also thinking of Guyana. I mean, Guyana was in a dispute with Venezuela about oil, and, you know, Guyana, you're in trouble, girl. How do folks follow the Alliance for Diplomacy and Justice and the work that you all do?
Well, thank you. You can definitely check out our website, and we have a link there to all of our appearances in the press, et cetera. We're also trying to put out statements when major events happen like this one. And so we have a statement on the Venezuela activities. We also have a statement on the Trump executive order that you mentioned at the outset of our conversation. And then we're trying to do events around the country. So we'll be in New York the first week of December, doing a number of public-facing events. So keep an eye open for that. We'll be at some of the local law schools, and we'll make sure that's announced on our website.
Thank you so very much, Beth. Have a wonderful rest of your day. We really appreciate you coming on.
Thank you, Nan. It was a terrific talking to you. Best of luck.
Thank you. That was Beth Van Schaik, who is the co-founder of the Alliance for Diplomacy and Justice, joining us to talk about the U.S. attack on Venezuela. We will have more with Stacey Yodell after this station break.
Hi, Hi, this is Michelle Coltrane. Join me every Saturday at 4 a.m. for my show, Awakenings. We will be taking a musical and spiritual journey into the world of Alice Coltrane and beyond. That's Awakenings every Saturday, 4 a.m. on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles and online for the world at kpfk.org.
Supreme reign over the universe. Om Shanti.
The benefits of donating your used vehicle to KPFK include funding new and existing programming, as well as increasing community awareness. You also benefit by being able to reduce your taxable income. There's no need to deal with the hassles of selling it, and you support public radio in the process. To donate your vehicle, please call 877-KPFK-AUTO. That's 877-KPFK-AUTO.
This is Dr. Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics and author of Parallel Worlds and Hyperspace. And whenever I'm in Los Angeles, I tune into my favorite radio station, KPFK 90.7 on your FM dial.
The blackness. Keep on.
Optimistic, not easy to be in these days. Optimistic from Sound of Blackness. You are listening to Sojourner Truth with your host, Nana Jumphy. Thank you so much for being here with us. January 7th of last year was a year that was devastating to all of us, and particularly those who were impacted by the fires in Altadena, Pasadena, and Pacific Palisades. It was a tragic, tragic event that brought community together to lift up those who had been most directly impacted, who continue to deal with the aftermath to this day. I'm so pleased to be joined by Stacy Yeldell to talk about the fires, the emotional toll, the support that was provided, the lessons that we can learn today. Stacy Yeldell is a board member of Vox Feminina, founder of Amantra, the best-selling author of Choose Yourself, a 12-week journal to becoming the God of your own heart. So important, the God of your own heart. Thank you so much, Stacy, for joining us.
It is such a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for having me again.
So first, we know you've been on before talking about the work of your organization, Project Hope, where you are a mental health and psychological support specialist. Please talk to us about Project Hope and particularly the work that you do.
Absolutely. So our mission at Project Hope is empowering local healthcare workers to save lives across the globe. That is our number one mission at Project Hope. And we do this by responding to disasters and health crises, pandemic preparedness and response, working with a burden of disease, also known as HIV and TB. We also specialize in maternal, neonatal, and child health and health policy. As you mentioned, my work with Project Hope has been primarily to provide what we call MHPSS, which is mental health psychosocial support in the face of emergencies. And that is how I was able to join Project Hope right after the fires last year to support the victims of the wildfire through mental health and psychosocial response.
And so I know for so many folks, it's visceral. For those of us that are from this area, meaning the Los Angeles, Altadena area, but there are some folks who are listening to this who, you know, aren't from here. It's not visceral to them in that same kind of way. Can you help folks get a picture when you got on scene, you know, you were coming in afterwards, I'm saying on scene, like you were walking into burning fires. I know that wasn't happening. But when you sort of connected up, what was the landscape that you were faced with at that time?
I mean, it was really utter shock. One of the ways that we became a part of this is because our deputy director lives in LA, woke up the morning of the fires, and you know, she's used to doing emergency response work, Project Hope internationally. And she saw that there was a real need for an emergency response here on the ground in LA, and that's never been done before. So that alone was a big deal. And, you know, there was a lot of shell shockness, a lot of people just, you know, not really believing what's going on. And you know, you have what happened in Palisades, and then you have the part of it with the Altadena. But across the board, the mental health impacts of this have been so far reaching and so widespread. And so we definitely identified a need, specifically as we began to shift to the Altadena neighborhood. So yeah, a lot of what you would think, a lot of stress, confusion, people were displaced, a lot of anxiety, uncertainty, because of course we know it's not just about the fires, but it's everything that comes along with it. It's the bureaucracy. It's trying to figure out, you know, what's going to happen with the land and, you know, whether a person is going to be able to move back into their home. And, you know, a lot of people having to go outside of their neighborhood and their communities, living in you know, neighborhoods they're not familiar with. And that happening indefinitely. A lot of, you know, temporary housing. So it was very, 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 very dysregulating and destabilizing, to say the least.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are folks I remember, you know, have friends, people that I know that were living in a house in Altadena that suddenly found themselves in a hotel room, like whole right. family, in Long Beach, which, mm-hmm. you know, if you know the area, and for those of you that don't, is on the complete other side of the county, almost, right?
Yes.
In terms of this greater LA area. And so that was very, you know, as you said, deregulating. People were suddenly finding themselves in a different place. And I think that people, and I'm glad you brought, I think that people don't get, and I'm glad that you brought up and want to talk a little bit more about that, that it's, yes, it's the fire, it's the loss. But, you know, if you could give us a little more detail about the kinds of other things that people had to deal with respect to, you know, the basic function of how they're going to get through the day with this mm-hmm. total upheaval of their life.
Well, I always kind of go to this, you know, UC Berkeley LA Times poll that found that 77% of the residents in the Eaton Zone rated their stress an 8 to 10 out of 10. And that comes from the fact that nearly half of the damaged homes were total losses. We saw a lot of sleep disruption, whether that be insomnia or trauma-related nightmares, exhaustion from the recovery, the paperwork marathon, they call it, which is having to go through insurance inventories, FEMA permits. We saw depression, anxiety, PTSD, which, you know, continue to be exacerbated by the current weather conditions, by the way. So whenever the winds pick up, right, whenever there are flood warnings or potential evacuations, then we see a lot of that grief coming right back, right? Because there wasn't just loss of home, but there were loss of landmarks. My colleague, Nadia, who works with me, she's an art therapist, her son's school burned down, for example, you know? So you have such a tight-knit community like Altadena, and the loss of the community is traumatic all within itself. So, you know, and then of course, you know, you have a lot of inequity, you know, particularly in Altadena with the historic redlining, which concentrated Black homeowners in the hardest hit tracks, and older and Black other homeowners of color were really kind of lagging in the rebuild process, which also compounds the stress exposure and the access hurdles. So, you know, when you look at the fact that these people are already dealing with intersections of other issues, other things that are plaguing us, and then the fact that a lot of the people who were impacted, particularly in Altadena, were older, then, you know, you really, really see communities with less insurance, more renters, language barriers, and histories of disinvestment are all also facing a higher exposure and longer recovery. And what that does, Nana, is it sustains the mental health symptoms. So that's why we're still seeing symptoms now, because as I'm constantly reminded, this is not post-wildfire response. People are still going through this. People are still having to figure it out. So it's not behind us. It's still very much happening for a lot of people.
Absolutely. Still don't have a place to stay. Some people still haven't gotten any real word from insurance. And, you know, we all have had to deal with insurance at one level or another. I don't care if it's because it was a car accident, something having to do with maybe not the regular in terms of health care, not the routine checkup, et cetera. And it's just so difficult. And thinking about, and thank you for lifting up the fact that a lot of the residents in Altadena were older. They had lived in those houses for decades. Mm-hmm. I don't even know how you account for that. Look, I ain't gonna lie. I live in this apartment for 10 years. If you told me to account for everything in here, I'm gonna forget things.
Exactly.
Right? I'm gonna forget things. And there are some things that money does not replace. And those things are just gone. And just the stress of that alone is really a lot. What did you learn? And did folks at Project Hope learn from their conversations with you? From residents, from folks that were impacted by the fire that you think it would be good for us to think about as we commemorate this 1 year in the midst of a lot of other crises that are happening.
Absolutely. I mean, I think I talked the last time in when I was doing the emergency response in Jamaica. One of the things that I learned is the same thing that I've learned this time, which is that I can't presume to know what people need for themselves, right? There is no cookie cutter, you know, mental health program that's going to help everybody across the board. So we learn to listen. We learn to really listen to what people are saying that they need, what is coming up for people, and then to craft programming around that. Specifically, when you look at mental health in communities that are, you know, people of color, we have to deal with the stigma of mental illness oftentimes. So we learn to listen and we learn to pivot. We learned how to address the concerns that were coming up in real time and how to, you know, to support in ways that may seem out of the box. So, for example, it wasn't just about doing workshops and having programs. There were certain opportunities, particularly around the holidays, where we responded by doing donations, by making sure that grocery carts were distributed to families, you know, that were impacted by the wildfires. We made it a point to put together self-care bags because we were told that that's one of the things that's fallen by the wayside. People are so busy trying to figure out where they're going to live and what the basics are that they feel almost guilty to want warm socks or to have a journal to journal in. So we made sure that we put together, you know, drawstring bags with, you know, journals and socks and self-care bath items and things of that nature. So the biggest thing I think for me that I've learned is to listen and to really, really not assume that I know, you know, and I was corrected. Like, that's why I say it's not post-wildfires. Like, I was doing a workshop saying post-wildfire response, and somebody put their hand up, one of the Altadena residents, and said, excuse me, this is not post. We are still very much in this. So it was, for me, a lot of listening and a lot of humility, as I mentioned, with the Jamaica response, and really, really being open and asking, how can we support you? How can we best support you at this time?
Question with respect to like pulling together of resources. So did you mainly work with people that are part of Project Hope in terms of providing the support for community, or did you make a call out to other therapists? How did that part work? Or other healers? How did that part work?
So it's interesting because since Project Hope's main goal is to empower healthcare workers, the way that Project Hope went about the response was to hire local healthcare workers, which that's me. So I was brought in as a healthcare worker to support my local community since I am local. And they also hired another mental health specialist. And then we have another one now who's a mental health specialist who's also local. As I mentioned, her son's school burned down. So Project Hope's main thing is to hire and to empower local healthcare workers to address the needs of the community. Now, with that said, Project Hope is a nonprofit, and so we rely on the generous donations from our donors to continue to do this work. So we are funded, so that makes it so that we've been able to do all of this at no charge of the people we're working with. So whether it be a donation, whether it be grocery cards, whether we're doing direct programming with workshops, all of that is provided at the luxury of the fact that we have such generous donors that have supported us in this response.
And is this work continuing? As you indicated, it's not post, we're still in it. folks, you know, some people, they're telling them that they can't even look at the land still, that they cannot, they're not going to probably be able to move back for, you know, a couple more years, et cetera, et cetera. So is the work of Project Hope continuing, or is there a way in which sort of tools are given and then the community picks it up from there?
So a little bit of both. We do hope to continue to become, you know, be more funded throughout the year. And we always work, though, with the intent of creating autonomy within the people we are working with. So that is by empowering community leaders is a big thing that we're really focused on doing. And one of the ways we've did that over the past year is doing the mental health programming with the frontline responders. That's a huge part of the work that we do to make sure that the people who are responding, so that is, those are healthcare workers, people who are in any way directly connected to providing services or support to this community and to survivors, to make sure that they are taken care of. So we've done a lot of workshops and programming and donations and care bags. And, you know, we call them kitting events, K-I-T-T-I-N-G, where, you know, we actually put together and have other people, organizations come and put together these kits to provide for the frontline responders so that they can continue to keep doing the beautiful work that they're doing. So one of our main strategies was to support the healthcare workers first, and we're still doing that. And at the same time, a lot of what we do when we're working with people is we help them to build what we call like resiliency toolkits. And that's a little bit about what we were talking about last time in about Jamaica, where the goal is to help people to gain self-regulation tools so that they can continue to heal themselves and support themselves long after Project Hope has left the ground. And that's really the overall goal. And as a clinician, I feel like that's the goal for as a therapist in general, because there's just simply not enough of us in the world that, you know, they're not going to be enough therapists, enough clinicians. So to when we're working with clients and we're working with people in the community, the goal for me always is to support, but to also empower and to instill and to cultivate practices that they can continue to utilize long after, you know, we're gone, after the funding's spent, you know, or however way the services come to an end, people still are able to say, I have tools. I have tools that are going to help to build resiliency, not just from this crisis, but from any other crisis that may come.
I think, you know, thank you so very much. And I'm so thrilled to speak with you, as you know, always, because I think that this conversation around what are the tools that we have to be able to be resilient, in particular in this time. Stacey, it has been terrible. I mean, yes, I just don't even know what else to say. It has been terrible. You know, it's like we went on break. I'm the ED of the Black Alliance for Just Immigration. So we deal with Blackness and we deal with immigration. Think about that. And we went on break and I have not felt any break. I have, you know, the year started with the bombing of Somalia and ended with the bombing of Nigeria and then the bombing of Venezuela on the other side and the seizure of the president. And then what we see happening with the body snatchers, which is more than ICE, folks. It's more than ICE. It's all the cops, which ICE is just a cop. Out here in these cities, and now the killing of Renee Wood, but that's just one killing, even though it matters. But there are so many others that also have happened that ICE has been engaged in, including an off-duty ICE cop that killed Mr. Porter here in Los Angeles New Year's Eve. But there's probably been at least six other people killed since the invasion of Chicago. And then we see what's happening just, you know, across the board in so many places and what's going on with healthcare and just all these pieces. And I feel like I'm tight. And I feel like when I talk to other people, they're also tight. Not mean, right? But just feeling like we are on some kind of wheel that we can't get off of. And really looking for what are some of these tools that we can use to be able to hold ourselves, right? To hold the center, as the South Africans would say, to have stones in our stomach, right? To keep ourselves sort of grounded. And so can you share, you know, we don't have a lot of time, but can you share one maybe two of those techniques that we could be using in order to help ourselves as we continue to move forward, because move forward we must in these times.
Absolutely. And you nailed it. There is a non-stopness to it all. The nervous system is not meant to be constantly on alert. That is not how our brains are designed. So that's the first thing, is to recognize that our nervous systems are on overdrive. And the what I like to do is to first start off by identifying, am I hyporegulated or am I hyperregulated? Hyporegulated, H-Y-P-O, is when I'm shutting down. I'm starting to zone out. My limbs feel heavy. I don't want to get out of bed. I'm depressed. I'm heavy. If I'm hyporegulated, then I need to find ways to bring vitality and movement to my body. That's getting a massage. That's taking a walk. That's, you know, actually bringing life back to my body through subtle movements. Hyperregulated is when I'm angry, agitated, anxious, and having panic attacks and moving in a hyper way. When that happens, I know that I need to ground myself. I know I need to soothe myself. That's when I want to eat soothing foods, do artwork, listen to soft music. So understanding and identifying where your nervous system is the first thing to self-regulate. And it's very easy. Either you figure out whether you are going hyper or if you're going hypo. Hypo is freeze response. Hyper is when you're in fight flight. So once you identify that, and you can identify by your behavior, is your heart rate up or is your heart rate low? Which one is happening? And then once you identify that, then you know which tools to use. And the way I like to do that is, first thing you ask yourself is, what do I need? What do I need in this moment right now? And that sounds like a very simple question, but let me tell you, it is a revolutionary question, because a lot of times we don't really ask ourselves that. And a lot of times we're hyper-focused on what other people need. So when you ask yourself what you need, even if it's a word or a color or a scent, then practice giving yourself what you need. Even if you've got to take a micro moment of going to the bathroom and sitting down on the, putting the lid down and sitting down and imagining you got roots growing at the bottoms of your feet, right? If you're a visual person, that's something you can do, right? Actually see yourself being grounded into the earth. See yourself releasing all of that garbage, which we're taking in that isn't even ours to carry, right? So doing that release work, doing that grounding, connecting to the earth, finding ways to ground, like you said, to ground yourself so that the nervous system can begin to come back into a place of regulation. And the last thing I'll say is boundaries, boundaries, boundaries. We do not have to take on and take in every single thing that's coming at us in order to be effective in life. We do have the opportunity, and we do get to give ourselves permission to turn off the radio, not Sojourner Truth. Do not turn off Sojourner Truth. Keep listening to Sojourner Truth. But turn off those other things that are contributing to the dysregulation of the nervous system. Set those boundaries. Don't have those conversations with those people who drain you, right? Literally begin to notice the energy leaks that are happening and act accordingly.
That was so helpful. That's really helpful. And I think it's helpful also for those of us that are working with others, right? Whether we're working with others, particularly in the work of community support, social justice work, whether we're doing so with our cadre, meaning it's not even a nonprofit, it's just some folks that have gotten to come together to try to do something, or whether we're working in organization, I think doing that for ourselves and being able to share with others, right? Because that's another thing that I think becomes an issue as we sort of wind down the last couple of minutes, because we look at, you know, sometimes I'm thinking of others and I'm like, I see you're in a freeze response, right? And, you know, how can I help you to get out of that freeze response? And it's kind of hard for me to think about that, but I think you've shared some information that helps with that. Is there any, maybe a couple other things that we could ask somebody or say to someone who we see in a response in order to help them to, in terms of their resilience and picking up some tools?
I mean, I think it's a really good thing to, after we feel ourselves grounded, right? That's when we go into a parasympathetic state, right? When we feel like we're grounded and we're calm, you're right. That's when we can support other people, right? Oftentimes we'll try and support people when we are ourselves dysregulated. And that doesn't often work, because we want to be able to co-regulate, meaning once we're grounded and regulated, then we can go to someone and say, what do you need? How can I support you? Sometimes people just want to be seen. A lot of times it's just being able to be heard, right? And just listen, let that person tell you what it is that they need or what they're feeling or what's happening, you know? And then if you're close to that person or if you're working with that person as a client, then help them to resource themselves, right? I actually make lists with my clients. What are the things that help you to feel good and grounded and connected to yourself? You know, what brings you joy? Really, really bringing ourselves back to what are our resources. And then utilizing those resources, resource ourselves like we are traumatized, because we are, right? A lot of times we are. And that's what we do when we work with trauma as clinicians. We sit with the person, we have them make a list of their resources, and we work with them to begin to slowly resource themselves back to health. So once you're in a nice regulated state, then you get a chance to support someone else to help them to discover what helps them to feel regulated, what helps them to feel safe. And what are those things that don't move?
Right.
What are those things in your life that are in place that don't move? And a lot of times that takes me into my internal resources, the things that my own internal strength, the rocks in my belly. What are those things for me? And just sitting down and writing 1 to 3 and writing down those 3 things that for you don't move, that you can rely upon no matter what, that's a game changer all by itself.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you so much, Stacey. How do people follow your work if they want to follow you, please?
Oh, absolutely. Well, I'm on Instagram. Not that I post much, but I am on Instagram at Stacey Amon Wellness. That's STACIEAA, 2 A's, M as in Mary, O as, and as in Nancy, Stacey Amon Wellness. And also Project Hope. You know, we have got an awesome website. We're doing a lot of amazing things. And we are, again, we are who we are because of our donations. And so if you are anybody out there philanthropic and want to continue to help to support the wildfires, I can tell you firsthand that support is so appreciated and allows us to continue to keep doing the work that we're doing in the community. So thank you in advance. And thank you for having me back. I'm so glad we got to talk about tools. That's my favorite subject.
Excellent. Thank you so very much, Stacey. We'll have you back again. Have a wonderful rest of your day. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Peace and blessings. Thank you.
Peace and blessings. All right, folks. That is our show. I'd like to thank our guests, the Sojourner Truth team, including my dear sister, Margaret Prescott, our board operator, Ozzy Flamenco, and assistant producer Gary Scott, and you for continuing to support this show. Let's get together at the same time and the same place next week for Sojourner Truth Radio. Be well.
I'm Laura Flanders. Make your tax-deductible donation to kpfk.org today. Membership has privileges. Becoming a sustaining member of KPFK, keeping independent radio alive at kpfk.org. You can't beat it. Free speech radio can't survive without your generous support. So become a KPFK sustaining member right now. You can pledge as little as $1 a day at kpfk.org. And thanks.
ICE is escalating deportation operations around the Los Angeles area. But if you are stopped by ICE officers, you have constitutional rights, regardless of your immigration status. If you or someone you know has been detained or wants to report ICE, more information is available at CIRLA at 888-624-4752 for legal help and resources. It is bilingual. More information at CHIRLA.org.
Yo, yo, what's up? It's Emiliano.
And Just the Best.
Coming at you with the sickest, most happening show on the airwaves every Friday night.
That's right. It's Soul Rebel Radio. Oh my goodness. I just can't contain the excitement.
Well, hold on there, Jess. What's the deal with Soul Rebel Radio?
Well, let me tell you and all the beautiful people of SoCal that Soul Rebel Radio is the best show on the air. Always coming at you with the best mix of segments around.
What? Like what?
Well, there's music, health, fitness, always with new producers dropping a 411 each week.
That's right. Our contributors rotate from week to week, so you never hear the same thing twice. Then, we've got probably the most varied show on the air. It's like a box of chocolates. You'll never know what you're going to get.
If you're on the way home from work, pumping iron at the gym, or just chilling at home, Soul Rebel Radio is here to keep you company. Tune in every Friday at 7 p.m.
That's right, 90.7 KPFK. Soul, 90.7 KPFK. Soul Rebel
Radio.